For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is January 24th, and we are in Parshas Pinchas. And we're on page 878. So we began the count of the Jews, the count of the Bnei Yisrael. As we mentioned last time, this is the second time they're being counted. They were counted at the beginning of the 40 years. That was back in Parshas Bamidbar. And this is at the end of the 40 years, and they're being counted again. We discussed last time the reasons for the counting. So we did Reuven, which is the first of the tribes, and now we have 11 more to go. So we're not going to read every single one of the psukim, of the verses, for the next two pages, as it goes all the way to the bottom of 882. But I do want to pick out various points and discuss various points about this counting. This counting, as we mentioned last time, is different than the one in Bamidbar, in that the one in Bamidbar does not mention families. It only mentions tribes. So Yehuda had this much, and Yisachar had that much, and it adds them all up. But here we have them listed by family. So let's look at Shimon. Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. B'nei Shimon l'mishpachosav, the children of Shimon according to their families. Lin Mu'el, mishpachas ha-Nemu'eli. To Nemu'el, the family of the Nemu'eli. Liyamin, mishpachas hayamini, to Yamin, the family of Yamini. Liyachin, mishpachas hayachini, to Yachin, the family of Yachini. We discussed last time also about the repetition, how it says the family, it says the name of the patriarch, and then it says the name of the family using a prefix of a he and a suffix of a yud. We talked about that last time as well. So, let's hold a place here on page 878, and let's look at where we see the families listed, actually before their families, when they were just individuals. That would be way back in Parshas Vayigash, when Yaakov and his family come down to Mitzrayim, after Yosef reveals himself to the brothers, and they go back, and they get Yaakov, and they come down to Egypt. So there we get a list of the 70 souls that came down to Egypt. And that would be on page 258. In page 258, in the Stone Chumash, Pasuk Ches, verse 8, in the middle of the page. So there we have, Ve'ele Shmos B'nei Yisrael HaBoim Mitzrayimah, and these are the names of the Jewish people coming to Egypt. Yaakov Uvanov, Yaakov and his sons, Bechor Yaakov Reuven, the Bechor of Yaakov, the firstborn, is Reuven. And then it lists Reuven's sons. Uvnei Reuven, Chanoch, Ufalu, Vechetzron, Vecharmi. Let's look at Shimon, since that's the one we just read. Uvnei Shimon, who are the sons of Shimon? Yimuel, V'yamin, V'ohad, V'yachin, V'tzochar, V'sha'ul ben Akenanis. So there are six sons of Shimon mentioned. Yimuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yachin, Tzochar, Sha'ul. See if we can remember all of those. Let's hold the place here on 258 and turn back to 878. So what do we have here? The verse we just read, Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. B'nei Shimon, l'mishpachosam, the sons of Shimon to their families. Lin Mu'el, mishpachas ha-Nemu'eli. Well, that's consistent, sort of. In Vayigash, his name is Yimuel. And in Bamidbar, in Pinchas, his name is Nimuel. It's the same person, with a slight difference in how his name is written. The next one, Liyamin, Mishpachas HaYamini. Well, back in Vayigash, the second son is Yamin. That's consistent. That works. And then it says in Pinchas, Liyachin, Mishpachas HaYachini. So Yachin is the next son. Well, we skipped one, because back in Vayigash, between Yamin and Yachin, there's a son named Ohad, who is not mentioned here in Parshas Pinchas. So We have son number one, son number two, son number four. We miss son number three. And son number one is actually written a little differently. Instead of Yimuel, it's written Nimuel. Now there are two more mentioned in Vayigash, Tsochar and Shaul. So if we go to the next verse in Pinchas, on the bottom of the page, Yud Gimel, verse 13, Lezerach Mishpachas HaZarchi, he wasn't mentioned in Vayigash. That's a person, a new person. And Lishaul Mishpachas HaShauli. So Shaul is mentioned, but in Vayigash, there was a person named Tsochar, and here it's a person named Zerach. So there's two different things going on over here. First of all, we're missing a name. We're missing a son. It's each of the sons developed into families. We're missing somebody. And also, we have different names. We have a subtle change of Yimuel to Nimuel, but then we have Zerach, who seems to be a different person, because before it was Tsochar. So Rashi tells us in Parshas Pinchas that Zerach and Tsochar are the same person. That Zerach and Tsochar are the same person. Hold on 1 second. You have a choice. You can either take over there or move chairs however you wish. You can sit at this table if you prefer, wherever you're comfortable. So, Zerach and Tsochar, Rashi tells us, are the same person. Just as we intuit that Nimuel and Yimuel are the same person, Zerach and Tsochar also are the same person. We're on page 878. So, Rashi says they're the same person. Now, that's not so shocking, because Zerach means what? What does Zerach mean?
Seed.
Zera means seed. It's hard to hear with the mask. Zerach, Zayin Reish Ches, like Hashemesh Zarcha, means the sun shone, or rose, or shone. That's what it means. Zerach means to shine. And Tsochar, really, if you got to change the Ches to a Hey, really, to get the real meaning, but Tsochar or Tsohar also means to shine. So the words are related. Rashi says they're the same person. So, If you would do a study here of taking all of the 70 names listed back in Vayigash and look at all the families here in Pinchas, which we could do, and if we did that, we would find some subtle differences and some significant differences. The reason we're not going to do that is because I don't have an answer for every time there's a difference. I can point out where the differences are. Rashi points out many of them. But I don't have an answer as to why in each case this difference or that difference is made. For instance, Yimuel and Nimuel, I don't know why it changes from a Yud to a Nun. I do know it's the same person, but I don't know why it changes. That it's not so unusual for people to have their names pronounced or written slightly differently in different places. For example, for those of you who are in the Yirmiyahu class, so we have King Yehoyachin, who is also called Yechaniah, same person. But the name is written slightly differently depending on where you see it. Nebuchadnezzar is sometimes called Nebuchadrezzar, same person. So you find that in Tanakh, that a name sometimes changes subtly, sometimes more, not just subtly, sometimes more significantly. So that's not shocking that it happens. We like to have an explanation for why it happens, and sometimes Chazal give us the explanation, but not always. So I don't have a ready answer for every time there's a change between Vayigash and Pinchas, which is why we're not going to go through each and every name. But I do want to address the more significant point, which is, here we find a name missing. The family of Ohad doesn't exist. In Vayigash, we had the name Ohad as the third son of Shimon. And here in Pinchas, there is no such family of Ohad. So this is not an isolated case. If you go through the names, you will find that there are many names missing. Binyamin is a significant one. In Parshas Vayigash, he has 10 sons. And in Pinchas, only 5 families show up for Binyamin. So, why do we find those differences? So, there is the, we'll call it the simple explanation. And simple probably means that it's true most of the time. And then we have the Medrash, which we will touch on. The Medrash is built on a little bit more of an in-depth explanation. The simple explanation is this. Shimon had all these sons. So, ostensibly, each one of them could have developed into a separate family. In under Shimon. Shimon has the Nemuel family, and the Yachin family, and the Shaul family. He's got all these families. Not every single one of his sons would have necessarily developed into a large family. It's possible that the Ohad family just didn't have many offspring. So even though, yes, there is this Ohad person, but his descendants just didn't develop into anything significant. And therefore, as Rashi explains, when that happened, then sometimes some of the families were subsumed under the other families. I'll give you an example of that. Rashi tells us in Parshas Vayechi, when Yaakov gives the bracha to Yosef's sons, Ephraim and Menashe, and he says, I'm giving you a bracha, Yosef, that your 2 sons will each be considered a shevet. They'll each be considered their own tribe. They'll be counted as the 12 tribes, Ephraim and Menashe. They're counted along with their uncles as tribes. But Yaakov throws in a caveat. What happens if Yosef has more sons? What if Ephraim and Menashe now have more brothers? Now, we don't know of any that ended up being born, but what if it would have happened? Yaakov says, and Rashi explains it in Parshas Vayechi, if Yosef would have had more sons, they would have simply been under the umbrella of either Ephraim or Menashe. Even though they wouldn't be descendants of Ephraim or Menashe, they would be pushed into the group of either Ephraim or Menashe. There wouldn't be any more tribes coming from Yosef, even if he had more sons. So here as well, just because Shimon and other of the tribes as well had more sons, that doesn't necessarily mean that every single one developed into its own unique family unit. So that is the simple explanation, and over the course of many years, that's going to happen. You know, some of the families are going to thrive and grow much bigger, and some of the families aren't going to be that big. So they're just going to be put under the umbrella of the other families. That's the simple explanation. However, there's a more complex explanation. It's not complex in understanding, it's just complex in figuring out when to say it. And that is that we know there were events that happened over the 40 years. And not just over the 40 years. In Egypt, there were just years and years and years. People were sometimes killed. There were calamities that happened. There were plagues that took place. The golden calf, there was a plague. Many people died. There was a plague that took place when they complained about the meat. There were different complaints that happened and people died. So sometimes those plagues affected specific families and certain families were lost because of the plagues. So Rashi explains, for example, let's take Shimon, which is what we're into right now. So on page 878. We actually turned the page to 880. We read the names of Shimon's sons. Well, let's look at the total number. Pasuk Yudal, verse 14, top of the page of 880. Eile mishpachos haShimoni. These are the families of Shimon. Shnayim ve'esrim elef umasayim. 22,200. 22,200 happens to be the smallest of all the tribes. That's, Shimon was the smallest of them all. 22,200. Not only was he the smallest, he was the smallest by far. No other one of the tribes was under 30,000. And he's at 22,200. What makes matters more noticeable is that back in Parshas Bamidbar, at the first counting, Shimon's tribe was 59,300, which ranked him as number 3 out of 12 tribes. And here, he drops to the bottom, number 12 out of 12. A huge drop in the amount of Shimon. So Rashi explains, why would this have happened? And he says, because of the incident we just had at the end of Parshas Balak. The end of Parshas Balak, we had the unfortunate story of Zimri and Cusbi, and Pinchas killing Zimri and Cusbi. Remember, there was a plague at that time. Not only was there a plague, but there were Jews who were brought to court because of their behavior, because they worshipped Baal-Par, and they were executed. Many Jews were executed by the court because they did the Avera of idolatry, and they were warned, and they did it anyway, and there were witnesses, and they were put to death. So Rashi says, which tribe was Zimri from? Zimri was from the tribe of Shimon. So the Rashi says, therefore it makes sense that the predominant amount, the predominant deaths in among the Jewish people were from the tribe of Shimon. Not that they were exclusively the ones to be killed, but the majority of those who were killed in the incident of Zimri were from the tribe of Shimon, because they had a leader, Zimri, who was in the forefront of what was going on, and they followed their leader. And therefore, many of them were killed. So that would account for the huge drop in the tribe of Shimon from Bamidbar to Pinchas. And that would also account for the, perhaps, for the loss of an entire family. That it could be the Ohad family. They really were large enough to be their own family, except that with the incident of Zimri, there were so many of them killed that they lost that status of being their own family, because there just weren't that many people left from that family. So Rashi uses this formula to explain some of the omissions as you go through these names, of why certain tribes are missing some of their family names. And he says, because some of the incidents that took place throughout the wilderness that contributed to the reduction in some of the families. This is also why the final number, we're going to come back to some of this, but let's just skip ahead for a moment. What's the final number here in Parashas Pinchas on the bottom of page 882? The very last pasuk, the last verse, Nun Aleph 51. Ela Pikudei B'nai Yisrael, these are the counting of the B'nai Yisrael. Sheish Mayos Elef Va'alef, 601,000. Shva Mayos Ushloshim, 730. 601, 730. 601,000, 730. 40 years earlier, what was the number? 603,550. Slightly more. At the beginning of the 40 years, when you counted the men between 20 and 60, the number was 603,550. Here at the end of the 40 years, you count the men between 20 and 60, and the number is 601,730. Almost the same, just slightly less now than before. Normally, if you have a nation, a thriving nation, millions of people, and you give them 40 years, and you take a census, it should be more people. That would be the natural order of things. If it's peaceful, they're not at war, you don't have pandemics, God forbid, then the population should gradually increase. And after 40 years, we should have seen an increase of the numbers. But we didn't increase, because unfortunately, we had incidents that reduced our numbers. We didn't have terrible wars, but we did have plagues, and we also had sins. We had things that hurt us. And so our numbers did not increase. We didn't go down, I mean, very, very slightly, but essentially we stayed the same over those 40 years. So as I said, the tricky part about this approach, which is a true approach, but the problem with it is you don't know when to apply it and when not to apply it. It's a general idea that people died and therefore the numbers were reduced. And with Shimon, we can pinpoint an incident where Shimon was represented perhaps disproportionately. But it's hard to do that with all the other tribes to say, okay, this is the incident that reduced this tribe, and this is the incident that reduced that tribe. But naturally, we'd expect the tribes to increase. Which tribe increased the most from Bamidbar to Pinchas? Now, if they increased the most, then you would say, most likely, they were not so much affected by all the sins and the plagues and all that. That this tribe stands out as a tribe that seems to have been righteous. But generally righteous, that people didn't die, generally speaking. So which tribe? I don't think it's a tribe you would have picked out to say, like, this is the tribe that actually increased the most. By far, the number one increase of all the tribes. And the answer to that is the tribe of Menashe. Menashe increases by over 20,000 people between Bamidbar and Pinchas. Other tribes also increase, but not nearly as much as Menashe does. So if Menashe increased to that level, we have to assume that by and large, the people of Menashe played it right. They were on the straight and narrow. They were not largely represented in the sins of the Jewish people. Now, we can't say they didn't sin at all. For example, the golden calf, the truth is the golden calf is not a good example over here, because the golden calf preceded the first census. We want sins that happened after the first census between the two. So we don't want to use that one. But I was going to say, the golden calf, we know the only tribe that did not sin was Levi. All the other tribes sinned. We don't know what proportion each tribe sinned, but Levi was the only one that didn't sin at all. But in the other incidents where people were killed and there were sins and there were plagues, apparently Menashe was the least represented in all those unfortunate incidents. So that's an important point to notice about Menashe, about his increase from the 40 years. You would have expected some sort of increase along those lines from all the Jews, but only Menashe displays that level of increase over the 40 years. In Yehoshua, in Sefer Yehoshua, we find that the tribe of Menashe comes to Yehoshua and says, the land that you have given us is not enough for us. And the Mefarshim say Menashe increased disproportionately, just continued to increase disproportionately. The trend we see here will continue into Sefer Yehoshua, where the tribe of Menashe will just increase and increase and increase and increase. What do we find about the way that Menashe inherited land in Israel? Okay, so Menashe got on both sides of the Jordan River. So we'll learn about it. When we get to it, we're going to explain why Moshe Rabbeinu took specifically from Menashe, and because it was only Reuven and Gad that had asked for the land on the other side of the Jordan River. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, okay, Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Menashe. So we're going to talk about that. Why Menashe? Why didn't he pick half the tribe of Naphtali? Why Menashe? So we'll discuss that. But as a very simple approach, Menashe had a lot of people. They just had a lot of people. So if you're going to split one of the tribes, Menashe makes sense, because they just kept increasing and increasing and increasing, and so it made sense to give them more land and to give them two places in Israel. Okay. There is a chazal that says that if you count all of the numbers of families of the Jews here in this count, so you will end up with 57 families. As I said, there are some families that are mentioned back in Vayigash that are not mentioned here. There are 70 listed, but that's a little bit misleading, because the 70 that are listed over there include the tribes themselves, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, etc. And also Levi is counted. Here we don't have Levi in this count. like before in Bamidbar, Levi is counted separately. So you have 57 families listed. We're going to have a count of Levi as well. I don't think we're going to get to it tonight, but we will have Levi being counted as well, and he will contribute 8 families for a total of 65 families. That's how many families there will be. So Chazal tell us, we should read it together. I don't remember where the pasuk is. Give me a moment. I could quote it to you, but I'd rather we read it together. It'll be much better to see it inside. One moment, please. So the pasuk is in, it's in Sefer Devarim. Okay, I apologize. It's a bad thing to have dead air for the people who are listening. The people online see me, but there are going to be people listening to this year at some point. But what we're going to do is I'm going to tell it to you, and then hopefully I'll find it while I'm talking. So, the pasuk tells us in Sefer Devarim, Hashem says to the Jewish people, Lo merubechem mikol ha'amim. It's not because you're more than the other nations, that you number more than the other nations. That's not why I chose you. That's not why I love you. Ki atem hama'at mikol ha'amim. Because you are the fewest of all the nations. You're not very large, you Jews. So it's not because of the you have so many people, because you are of the fewest of everybody. So the gematria of the word hameat, the fewest, hameat, hey mem ayin tes. Hama'at. I'm sorry. No, not the gematria. That's wrong. Sorry. Hama'at. Hey, ma'at. Hey is five. Ma'at is fewer. You are five fewer than the nations of the world. The nations of the world are 70 nations. You have 65 families. So you are five fewer than the nations of the world. That's what Chazal tell us about the count of these families here, these 65 families, based on that verse in Sefer Devarim, which I still have not pinpointed. 978. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, 978, Pasuk Zion, verse 7. That was Mrs. Leff's incredible memory. She pulled it out of her head. Very good. Okay. So, Pasuk Zion, verse 7. Lo merubechem mikol ha'amim. Not because of how many you are from all the nations. Chashak Hashem bachem vayivchar bachem. Hashem desired you and chose you. Ki atem ha-me'at mikol ha'amim. Because you are the fewest of all the nations. Hey me'at. Five fewer than all the nations. Rashi also tells us over here that another incident contributes to the reduction in the numbers of families. And that is an incident which I mentioned to you before, but we'll repeat it now. And that is that when Aaron died back in Parshas Chukas, we know that the clouds disappeared. When the clouds disappeared, so then Amalek attacked. With the incident of the attack of Melech Arad was mentioned back in Parshas Chukas. We learned about it. And they attacked. So when they attacked, the Jews got scared. So when they got scared, after that attack, the Jews turned around and tried to go back to Egypt. They tried to run back to Egypt. Which is an incredible thing, because it's at the end of the 40 years. We're talking 40 years after they left Egypt. We still felt like we didn't have a place. We still felt vulnerable. And when those clouds disappeared, we really felt vulnerable, and we turned around to try to go back to Egypt. The Levium chased after the Jews, caught up with the Jews, and there was a civil war. And people were killed on both sides. Many of the Jews were killed, many of the Levium were killed. And Rashi explains that's why some of the families here are not represented, because many of those families were either wiped out or mostly wiped out in that civil war that took place when the Levim chased after the Jewish people. So that incident is not mentioned explicitly in Chumash. It is in the Yerushalmi, it's in the Medrash, and it is hinted to in a couple of places, and this is one of the areas that that is applied.
Rabbi,
yes?
Is it an anomaly, like the daughters of Salakad, because that's another way a family could die out, is not by having sons.
Right.
So was that like an anomaly, or did that happen more frequently also?
That may have happened also. That may have happened. The daughters of Salakad are the only ones to come forward with their I was going to say complaint, grievance, whatever you want to call it. But they're considered to be great righteous women, and as we'll see, they were also considered wise women, that they knew how to state their case. So we're going to learn about them, not tonight, but very, very soon. We're going to get to the Bnei Salafchad. So it's possible there were others besides them, but I don't know. You would have to say that the family predominantly had girls, you know, all the way down over the course of time. So it's possible. Okay, so let us move on now. Unless anybody has another question, move on to 884. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe lemar. Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, La'ele tein cholei ka'aretz benachala b'mispar shemos. To these, to this 601,730, you will divide up the land as an inheritance according to the number of the names. La'rav tar benachala so, for those who have more, you will increase their inheritance. V'lama'at tam'it nachala so, those who have fewer, you'll have less of an inheritance. Ish lafifi kudav, each man according to his count, yutan nachalaso, his inheritance will be given. This means that the tribes that had more people got more land. The tribes that had fewer people got less land. It didn't, the fact that the tribe had more or less people did not affect how much land they got. Because the land was given, since it was a census, so if there was a lot of people in the tribe got more land, others got less land. Ach bigorol yecholek es haaretz. However, with a lottery, you will divide up the land. Mishmos matos avosam incholu. According to the names of the heads of the tribes, you will inherit. Apia gorol, based on the lottery, according to the lottery, techolek nachalaso, you will give out, you'll divide up the nachala, the inheritance, bein rav limat, between those who have a lot and those who have a little. That phrase, al-pi ha-gorol, literally means by the mouth of the lottery. But we know that lotteries don't have mouths, so it means according to. It's an idiom, and it means according to. But we'll see, there is a medrash over here that it's very, very significant. Now, the giving out of the land is one of the very, very significant parts of the Torah that we don't think about so much today, because we don't all live in Israel, and even those who do live in Israel, you buy land, you know, you buy places to live. We don't have ancestral plots that we know of in Israel, even though theoretically we do. Theoretically, we each have an ancestral plot, but we don't know where it is, so we don't deal with ancestral plots. But really, we each have a portion of land in Israel. The only people, the only Jews that don't have a portion of land in Israel are the converts. A convert does not have a portion of land in Israel, because the land was given not only to those who left Egypt, not to those who converted later. But even a convert, it would only be the convert themselves that don't have land, or their sons or grandsons or great-grandsons. In other words, the son of a 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 convert would not have land. But any daughter that marries someone who is from a line that is not converts would have land, like anybody else. So most, the overwhelming majority of people, of Jews, have an ancestral plot. We just don't know where it is. We have one, but we can't identify it. It's there. The Levim and the Kohanim do not have an ancestral plot, but they did have cities that they were given in Eretz Yisrael. So they do have something. There's something that they own, but we don't know what it is either. But the giving out of the land was very, very important. And, as you might expect, it could have been the source of a great deal of machlokes. Just think about it for a moment. I think that everybody has had the experience, hopefully not personally, but either they've heard about it or they've seen it, where families will get into machlokes over an inheritance. Happens all the time. All the time. It's such a regular occurrence that families will argue over an inheritance. Imagine the Jewish people, as you know, we are so docile and we almost never disagree with each other. Imagine the entire Jewish people and the land of Israel and who gets what plot. You imagine the nightmare of trying to give out the land in Israel? It's just like, how do you handle such a thing? So, the way it worked was that it came from Hashem, but even coming from Hashem, anything short of Hashem appearing to each and every Jew and saying, this is yours, this is yours, this is yours, this is yours, anything short of that is subject to debate. And he wasn't going to do that. So what did Hashem do? So what he did is, he made it that the lottery was going to be public, and the lottery was going to have all kinds of miraculous parts to it. So first of all, the lottery did not work the way that you would expect it to work. The lottery had, it started off a lottery of tribes. 12 different portions in Israel, 12 different tribes. So there were two boxes. One box had the names of the tribes, 12 different pieces of parchment with the different names. Reuven, Shimon, Yehuda, Yisachar, etc. In that box. The other box also had 12 pieces of parchment with various pieces of land, large portions of land that were in there as well. Then there would be Yehoshua was there, and Elazar, the Kohen Gadol, was there, and Elazar was wearing the Urim and Tumim, is everything that he's supposed to have, and they would call up one of the heads of one of the tribes, let's say Reuven's head, and then it would say like this: when Elazar reaches into the two boxes, in one hand he's going to pick out the parchment with the name Reuven on it, and the other hand he's going to pick out the parchment with such and such a portion on it. And then he would reach his hands in, and that's what would happen. He would pick out one parchment from each box. One would say Reuven, one would say the precise portion that was originally said to be Reuven's portion, and then the Goral, the lottery, would call out and say, I, the lottery, declare that Reuven gets this and this portion in Israel. Which is why it says, Al Pi HaGoral, by the mouth of the lottery. The lottery spoke and said it, in order to make it clear that this is the portion of Reuven. No one can argue the point. Reuven can't argue the point. They want different land. None of the other tribes can say, we want that land. This is Reuven's portion. And it would come out exactly each of the 12 tribes. That's the way it would work. Now, there is an unusual system that was used for giving out the individual portions of land within the tribes. Normally, as the Gemara says, we say the Mesim are Yoresh, excuse me, the Chayim are Yoresh the Mesim. Those who are alive inherit from those who die. Right? That's the way it works. People are alive, they pass away, and their estate is inherited by their closest relatives, or to whomever they gave it out to during their lifetime. So, those who are alive inherit from those who passed away. Obviously, those who passed away don't inherit from those who passed away, because the land, the estate, is for the people who are currently alive. So the Gemara tells us that this inheritance worked backwards. The Mesim were Yoresh es Hachayim. Those who died inherited those who were alive. Well, what does that mean? So, the reason for this, let me tell you the reason first, then we'll explain what happened. When we left Egypt, what was supposed to happen is that we left, we went to Har Sinai, we got the Torah, and then we were supposed to go into Eretz Yisrael. We were delayed. First, we were delayed because of the golden calf, and that took another year because we then built the Mishkan, etc. And then we were delayed because of the spies for a total of 40 years. So we were delayed. So really, the inheritance was supposed to be given out to the Yotzei Mitzrayim, to those who left Egypt. But by the time we got to Israel, the men who had left Egypt were no longer alive. Their sons were now in their place. So, what do you do now? Do you give out the land to the next generation, or do you give out the land to those who left Egypt? Well, we were supposed to give the land out to those who left Egypt, but they're not alive anymore. Okay, let's give it to their sons. But that's not what it said we're supposed to do. We're supposed to give it to the ones who left Egypt. So how do we reconcile that? So this is the way it worked. You did both. You gave the land to those who were currently alive, the Ba'ei Ha'aretz, those who entered the land, and you gave the land to the Yotzei Mitzrayim, to those who left Egypt. So how would that work? So it worked as follows. Let's say you had two brothers that left Egypt. You had two brothers that left Egypt. I don't want to use the names Reuven and Shimon because I don't want to use tribes' names because these are members of tribes. So we're going to call them Beryl and Shmerel. So Beryl and Shmerel left Egypt. You didn't know they had Yiddish names when they left Egypt. Right. There was Beryl and Shmerel when they left Egypt. Beryl and Shmerel were of the Yotzei Mitzrayim. They're two men who should have entered the land but didn't, because they died during the 40 years. So when they left Egypt, they were supposed to each get a portion. But they both died. Beryl had three sons. Shmerel had one son. Now, it's time to enter the land. So Beryl's three sons are now ready to enter, as is Shmerel's one son. So each of those four men get a portion. So they each get a portion. So if we were only going to follow the rule of those who enter the land, then these four men, the three sons of Beryl, the one son of Shmerel, would each get a portion that was equal to the other one. Four portions, all equal. Beryl's son number one, Beryl's son number two, Beryl's son number three, and Shmerel's son each get equal portions. If it would have been Beryl and Shmerel who got land, then they each would have had an equal portion. And that means that now the three sons of Beryl would have inherited one portion. That means they each now have a third of a portion, because they're only getting a third of their father's. And Shmerel, who's the only son, Shmerel's son, who only has one son, he has a full portion. So what happened is, if you follow those who left Egypt, that Beryl's son has a full portion, because Shmerel's son has a full portion, inherited his father. Beryl's three sons divide up one portion into three. One third, one third, one third. Neither system was used. How did it work? What happened is, you gave four portions to Shmerel's three sons and Beryl. Beryl's three sons and Shmerel's son. Four portions. Then you say, okay, those four portions go back to their fathers, who are no longer alive. So now you look at it as if Beryl and Shmerel, who have since passed away, have four portions, because they had four sons between the two of them. They have four portions. Now you give those four portions to their sons, two to Beryl's sons, two to Shmerel's sons. So you end up with the following, that Shmerel's sons, three of them, divide up two portions. They each get two-thirds of a portion. Two-thirds, two-thirds, and two-thirds equals two. And the other one, he gets two portions. So it comes out, it's complicated. It is complicated when you think about it. It's a complicated formula. They would first examine who's alive today. That's the first thing they would do, and give out equal portions to whoever's alive today. Then they would bump it backwards and say those very portions would go back to the fathers who were alive when we left Egypt. And now give out those portions to their sons, divided up now according to what they were when they left Egypt. So it comes out to be a complicated formula. Some people ended up with more than they would have had. Some people ended up with less than they would have had. It just depended on how many there were. Clearly, in this example, where one brother has many sons and one brother has only one son, the one son is going to make out very well with this formula, because he's going to be able to glean off of his cousins. His cousins, who are many sons, they're going to, because of them, there's going to be a whole bunch of portions that are going to go back to the two fathers and divide it up equally, and he is going to end up with a whole bunch. And the families that are very large, where the cousins are very few, then that family is going to lose out. But that is the system that was going to be used over here, that the Mesim were Yarshim Esachayim. Those who passed away inherited those who were still alive. Not really, but the formula was, give it to those who are still alive, bump it backwards to those who have passed away, and then bring it forward again to the people who are still alive. In that complex method. And that's the way the land was divided up for the people going into Eretz Yisrael. Every year when I learn these parashios, and when I learn the Gemara and Baba Basra, I think about this, and it makes my head spin. And we leave it at that. But it is a complicated formula that clearly Hashem did not want it to be that this is only going to be based on those entering the land. He did not want it to be that those who left Egypt are totally ignored in the giving out of the land. That the right to the land is still ultimately going to date back to those who left Egypt. That Hashem didn't want to ignore that point. Now, there are still some important loose ends with the giving out of the land. For example, what's with the land in Israel, and what about the land on the east side of the Jordan River? What was supposed to happen with that land? We're going to have later on that Reuven and Gad are going to want that land. How is that supposed to be divided up? Where does that go? That we haven't talked about. We're just talking about generally the way that the land was given out. What happened to Reuven and Gad's portions in Israel itself? Since they took land on the other side of the Jordan, went onto their land on the Israel proper side of the Jordan, on the west side of the Jordan River. So there are some more details which we're going to have to cover regarding the giving out of the land, and we will cover that Mirtz Hashem when we get to Reuven and Gad, which will be in Parshas Matos, in the next Parsha. When we get to that, we'll talk about Reuven and Gad. This discussion, though, is directly going to lead to the Benos Tzelophchad. Not quite yet, because we have to go through Levi's family first, but the daughters of Tzelophchad, this is going to trigger that whole discussion, which will then trigger the entire discussion of inheritance, which has not yet been brought up in the Torah. The order of inheritance, how it works, has not been discussed yet. That's going to be here in Parshas Pinchas, which will be a direct result of this discussion of giving out the land. So that's going to be coming up we will get to that next week, Mirtz Hashem. We'll get to the Benos Tzelophchad And we'll see how that works. The
Rabbi?
Yes.
So what you're saying is someone like Korach or Dathan and Abiram who left Egypt get an inheritance of the land even though they did something really not good.
Okay, that's a good question. What about families like that? So the families that totally were wiped out, like Dathan and Abiram, there was nothing left of their families. So then their...
Korach had sons.
So his sons did get... But he's a Levi, so that's a technical point. But you're right. Really, that's what the daughters of Tzelafchad are going to come and say. Their father died. He was killed.
Of his own sins.
Right. But there still is land. He doesn't lose his right to the land. So that you're, in theory, depending on how bad they were, the spies, the Meraglim, their portions of land were given to Yehoshua and Kalev. They actually lost their land. But that's a very, very... You know, a person had to be really bad for that to happen. Otherwise, they sinned, they got punished, they were killed, but their land is still land. Just because they're bad doesn't mean their sons are bad. You know, that's so... Right. Right. There's another... One second. There was another loose end over here with the land. I can't remember now what the other loose end was. I had another one in my head. But we'll stumble across it at some point. The other points about the land that we have not yet covered, but this is the basic beginning of how the land is going to be divided up once we get there. Oh yes, as I mentioned before, the converts don't have land in Israel because they didn't leave Egypt. Since they didn't leave Egypt, they don't get land. So as I mentioned, today all of us have land, but not someone who is a direct descendant of converts. In Yechezkel, towards the end of Sefer Yechezkel, for those who were in the class for Yechezkel way, way, way back when we learned it, there Yechezkel describes the dividing of the land when Mashiach comes. So there are some very important changes that apparently are going to happen. One of them is the converts are going to get land in the time of Mashiach. Another one is that the land is not going to be the same as before, meaning Reuven's portion will change. Dan's portion will change. It's going to be a different portion. So I don't know how that works, meaning in theory, if Eliyahu Navi would come and tell me where is the Pransky plot in Israel, I would have a claim to that land. I would have a biblical claim to that land. It's my land. It's my family. It's legally my land. It was given to my family. If he would come and tell me where it is. What's going to happen when Mashiach comes and there's a redistribution? Do I lose that plot? I assume I lose that plot. I don't know. I don't know how it works. But Yechezkel describes a different division of land than what happens when Yehoshua takes them into Eretz Yisrael.
But didn't you say that it like goes all the way almost to Iraq, like it's going to be narrow?
Yeah, it is bigger.
And the mountains are going to melt,
yeah,
some of them, right? Except for Yerushalayim, right, which is going to go up. So like the topography,
yes,
changes,
right,
too.
That's a very good point. And mountains are going to break open, rivers, there's a whole change.
The earthquake, right.
Yeah, so, right. So I imagine you're right that has a lot to do with this because the land might not be so recognizable at a certain point. Yeah. And then surveying becomes a nightmare. How do you work that out? Right. And so you're probably right. So I don't know. I still think that today, in theory, if a person could figure out where their land was, they would have a claim to it. Even though, if Mashiach comes tomorrow, then everything gets redistributed. So I don't know how that works. So right now we're focused only on the division that happened when Yehoshua came into Eretz Yisrael, which would stand until today, but stands to change once that new distribution takes place. Okay. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.